You're just too good to be true. Can't take.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Mondays with my co-host Sandy Williams. And Sandy, Turkey,
yeah.
Israel, other nations, we are watching the upheaval in our nation. And you can kind of look around the globe and there's upheaval in many other nations. So there's something that's going on that people...
We have a pandemic of personality cult, sort of autocratic-leaning leaders across the globe, actually. I mean, we've got Putin in Russia. Erdogan, interestingly, Erdogan's running for a third term. The Constitution there provides for two terms. So it would be as if...
Turkey, just so people...
Erdogan and Turkey. And so when I was in Turkey a couple of weeks ago, my guide, a smart woman, was telling me how Turkey, what the political lay of the land was. She was an anti-Erdogan person, felt that Erdogan was sort of a strongman conservative, interested in introducing more of the Islamist tendency into the country. And she predicted that Erdogan was going to lose, number one, but she also said that Erdogan would lose the major cities and win everything else. So the Turkey... political landscape looks like ours, blue in the cities, red elsewhere. What happened yesterday apparently was that Erdogan took a slight plurality of the vote above his contender, but neither he nor the contender reached a majority, so they're going to have a runoff in a couple of weeks. There's an altogether strong possibility that Erdogan wins re-election and the cult of his personality continues. The contender was interested in talking about reinvigorating the application of Turkey into the European Union, bringing it closer to the West. Erdogan has done a very artful job of walking the razor's edge, being essentially friendly with the West and with Russia, but is definitely a personality cult leader. Netanyahu, same deal. He's been around Israel for a long time, and every time he gets elected, it's more of a personality cult associated with him. You can go to Hungary. You can go around the world and find this happening. And here we have it in the United States. Clearly, no one would suggest anything other than Trump is a personality cult type leader. And I think it relates to frustrations in all the countries with paralysis in democracy. You know, democracy is messy. It's people get impatient with it. They want something to happen. I think it's almost a cycle that after a period of time, people want to turn to strong-armed people to accomplish whatever. Frequently, it's to shut down the borders from immigrants or to take on issues associated with essentially the motherland. Frequently, that's what it is. That's kind of what it is here. Make America great again. It sounds an awful lot like what the mantra is in each of the countries for these strong-armed guys. And it's troublesome. It's very troublesome because in the 30s it led to fascism in a bunch of countries, and now it's just trending towards the removal of democratic rights in a bunch of countries. We point at China and say they're getting more oppressive and autocratic there. Well, that's where we're headed if we stand back and look at ourselves, and that's where a bunch of countries are headed.
So Sandy, if you just took Israel, for an example, and clearly whatever's going on in Israel, they've got to fix that internally. There's nothing the United States can do.
Well, I mean, the thing is, we probably should stand clear. We've been tinkering with too many countries. You know, I suspect that there are those in the CIA who would love to get into Turkey and try to tinker with this next election, and I suspect that there are people from the KGB, you know, the FSB in Russia and others who also would like to. Tinkering in other people's affairs is something that we've become more and more fraught with doing, but it's a problem, and we don't like people tinkering in our affairs. So, you know, the Israeli situation is a little more complicated. They want to retreat from the independent Supreme Court that they have.
Well, yes.
Their Supreme Court has powers a little different than ours. I think their Supreme Court can take up every
but
piece of legislation.
But it's a he.
It's a he. Netanyahu. Well,
he's got some backing.
He's got backing. I mean, he's got his coalition was basically heralded and brought in by the super right in Israel. So, you know, his coalition is its main. It's if it's on a three-legged stool, one of those legs is clearly the super conservative.
So and so in the midst of that, and not just the fact that they're going through this internal cleansing, I guess, or making the decision on which direction they're going to go. This Palestinian issue is now revving up, and so clearly. The direction that they go, whether or not Netanyahu and his cohorts win, is going to be what happens
I think the people of Israel are quite split about, for instance, the Palestinian state. And I suspect, I don't know this, okay, I'm going to assert something without knowing it, but I suspect that if polling were done in Israel about how the people feel about an independent state for Palestine.
They would say yes.
That they very much might say yes on a majority basis, but the conservatives say a very loud no, and the loud no is prevailing right now, even though I think all the world observers look at this and understand that a Palestinian state is an absolute necessity in the deck of cards needed to settle the problems associated with Israel
and
Palestine.
Well, because, Sandy, you've been there. The people probably want this to end. They don't want it to go on in perpetuity. And they're saying, look, enough already, right? Generationally, let's get beyond this, Sandy. Let's get beyond this. And for the sake of our children— And, you know, we're not going to continue forever in a battle that keeps rearing its head. What's to be gained by that?
Well, and, it's a small, intimate country. It's not something that's happening in a distant place. It's not at the Mexican border and you're living in Wisconsin. No, it's at the Illinois border and you're living in Milwaukee. So it's a very intimate subject about which people have a fair amount of knowledge. And I've just been surprised that they've been unable as a country to reach an agreement about what they do about Palestine and a Palestinian state, because I think there are plenty of countries in the world who could assure both Israel and the new Palestinian state of the protection of their being, right? The sanctity of the lines, the sanctity of each country would have a world might behind it. And I think that this would be something that could be an agreement that would be reached between the likes of Russia and the United States about standing behind the sanctity of lines that might be drawn for a Palestinian state.
So, Sandy, how much of this unrest globally in these countries is the fact that, again, generationally, the people are changing, and we're getting farther away from what we've been dealing with over the last five decades, and that these younger people are saying, hey, wait a minute.
Well, I do think there's an author, Karen Armstrong, who writes books about religion. She wrote a book about the war over God, which is about the swing of religion between conservatism and liberalism. And she points out, and her main thesis is that it's the onset of modernity, it's the onset of extreme technological change or an extreme social change that's brought on by essentially technology that causes people to retreat to extreme conservatism and to become fearful. And I think she's right about society generally, and I think what is going on in the world, I think that we underestimate the extent to which the internet and the transition to this modern world associated with the internet is causing a great deal of reaction socially. And I think in particular the young generation that's comfortable with it and the old generation that's worried about it are driven apart from one another. And, you know, I don't know what else are the fearful aspects of what's driving people into this, but I'm confident that fear is the motivator.
Well, Sandy, I guess I'm saying that the younger people in these nations, you know, are ready to move forward. That whatever it takes, they're ready to stop looking so far back in the past. It's their time now, and they don't live in that area that you and I
well,
are living in.
There's things that are operating across currents. Okay, one of the cross currents for young people is the shift of religion towards extreme conservatism. So there are plenty of young people in the Mideast who are feeling just as you said, they want to move forward. There's also a bunch of young people in the Mideast who've gone to madrasas and have adopted a very conservative view of Islam, and have a different view. Okay, and so that. There's that division, and that division exists in Israel as well. There are plenty,
as well as America,
and in America as well.
Right.
So we have the evangelical movement that has spawned a great deal of conservative thinking that crosses age boundaries as well as social boundaries. And so there is these cross currents. But I would simply suggest that at the basis of the swing towards conservatism and extremism is fear. And so that fear can be stoked from a standpoint of religion. It can be stoked from the standpoint of technology and economics.
So, Sandy, when we get back, I really want to delve a little bit deeper into, I don't care whether it's here, whether it's in Russia, whether it's in China, wherever it is, same thing with baby boomers in our generation. And you know, when I talk with younger people, man, they don't want to. The things that we're talking about, we got to worry about Russia, we got to worry about China, they're not, rallying with, we need more defense.
Right.
They don't care about that stuff.
Yeah.
Could the world be facing that with the changing demographic of these, you know, nations that maybe we can, you know. We got to go to break right now. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You know, Sandy, and this conversation that we're having, and Calvin is a perfect guy to kind of chime in on this. And what I'm saying to you, Sandy, is could it be that because at some point in time, the world is going to, you know, we're going to be gone. And I don't know if the love affair that we have with the past and what took place in our fathers and our grandfathers' lives and the distrust of other nations all over the earth and spending the wealth of the world preparing to kill other people. I don't know if the younger generation, Sandy, are going to see it from the perspective that our generation has, and then that we continue to cheer spending all that money on defense.
Well, you know, the younger generation is intertwined with each other in the internet. People who are gamers will have people from other countries participating in the games. You know, so do they travel? No, but do they seem to get to know one another in a virtual sense? Yes. Has that brought down barriers and has it raised awareness? Yes, it's made it much harder for countries to control thought processes because the internet is a leak. You know, it's a leak in the process.
It's not nationalist.
It's not. Yeah. So it's international, and so it's much harder for countries that used to have iron curtains and barriers to maintain those unless they make extreme restrictions imposed on the internet and its operations, which some countries are now trying to do, but it's not greeted well. And for instance, the Russian effort to mobilize 300,000 people resulted in hundreds of thousands of young Russians leaving the country in order to avoid the draft. And, you know, if Canada isn't going to extradite people who leave the United States to avoid being called up, if we had a big call up for a foreign military adventure, I'm quite certain that Canada would have a similar border problem to the one we have with Mexico, with Americans beating the drums to move into Canada to avoid the exposure to that war. I think the world is changing, and I think that's part of this process that the political process is currently reacting against, and that the baby boom generation in every country is trying to hold on to power. Erdogan's a baby boomer, right, in terms of his age. All these people are, and the establishment in all these countries continues to be controlled by people north of age 55. And so I think we're at a watershed point in history, and these watershed points involve intergenerational friction as well as social friction.
So Calvin, many of your friends, I know when I graduated from high school many, many moons ago, some of the guys chose to go to the military, and people celebrated sending their sons off to the military. It was akin to sending some off to college. And it was respected, Sandy, when you send your son off to the military. The same thing with the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And so the American people looked at those people who made those kinds of decisions. It didn't matter, Sandy. Sometimes it was even doctors' children, right? It wasn't just the poor or...
Although you remember that a lot of that fervor came after 2001 and 9/11 when it was much like the fervor after Pearl Harbor. And I felt that same surge. I remember thinking, you know, I should go instead of my sons. If they're going to call up people for a war, they should be taking people my age who've lived their life. You know, but I'm not talking about that kind of a situation now. I'm talking about one that's a politically derived, a politically decided upon conflict. I think if America ever is attacked, I think that there will be a pride and a resurgency of loyal interest in joining the military. But that's not what we've been dealing with for a long time.
So Calvin, your thoughts?
On like people my age joining the military?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have any friends that are in the military or have even really considered it.
Did you ever consider it?
Maybe for like 4 hours one time when I was thinking about how expensive college was.
And then you sobered up.
Yeah. I thought about it when it came to paying college, and I was like, yeah, there's no way I'm doing
but
that.
But you thought about it from the perspective of college, not from the perspective of...
I do think a lot of young people, I know some that I sit at coffee with, who joined for the purpose of getting the GI Bill support for college after the military. That's become sort of a recruiting item. You know, you can go to college with what you'll get after you get out of the military. And I suspect, Calvin, maybe that's what you were thinking about, huh?
Yeah, that's what I was considering. But yeah, largely, I don't know, war kind of boggles my mind. I don't know why someone would be gung-ho about going off.
You know, and I've talked to many young people like Calvin, Sandy, I'm sure as well as you have, and they're not. That's not something that they're, you know, want to even get involved in.
Well, you know, when you look at it, if you've been a student of history, if you're 20 years old and you've read history, you'd know that we've done these foreign military adventures like right. Vietnam, like the Gulf War, like Iraq. And people would scratch their head and say, why in the world would I go off and risk my life for foreign military adventures when it looks like every time we've called people up to do that, it's been a horrendous mistake.
Yeah.
You know, it's been a national mistake. It's not been to save America. It's been for reasons we can't even identify.
You know, Sandy, it's a great observation. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. Your thoughts? We'll be right back.
Get the second free, up to 100 prints. In-store only at 181st and Blue Mound.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation.
Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You know, Sandy, and maybe we're reflective because you and I and our generation sees, maybe it's what our parents saw in our generation. They saw the changes coming as they aged in their time and the way they saw the world. And so, as you stated, you can't hold on to it forever. It doesn't belong to us. We're just passing through it. Our parents saw that. And it comes a point in all of our lives that we have to acquiesce in. And that control mechanism has not been let go yet by your and my generation. It's coming, right?
Well, I think instead of us giving it up willingly, like I talked about wishing that Joe Biden or Senator Feinstein would see the light and decide to build the successor, you know, to have a succession process
right.
in place to allow the policies to be implemented by the next person. Instead, I think for the baby boomers, we're not going to give it up. It's going to be wrenched from our hands. It'll be, you know, as we get buried in the ground, we will be giving up the power that we currently
have. I don't
think
the great generation did that, did they?
No, I don't think they did. In fact, my recollection, based on my experience in the law firm I went to, was that They were ready, willing, and able to open the door because they were prospering from us, you know, so that prosperity to them was coincident with empowering their children, this huge generation of their children, 75 million of us, who created in the light of the post-war boom and the world condition, the coincidence of the post-war situation, the monopoly of the United States and the world economy, and the huge generation we had was a circumstance that was unique and highly prosperous and very prosperous for the great generation as they opened the door to us.
So you just took the words out of my mouth. The great generation was known for its sacrifice. More than anything else, during the wars and for their children and they lived vicariously through their children. We have not followed that path, have we?
No, I think we had so much attention provided to us. We had the world was our oyster, but we've been unwilling to pass it on. I think to some extent, it had to do with the capacity to continue making enormous sums of money as we, you know, the retirement age. Many people resisted retiring when they got to retirement age. They wanted to hold on to what they had. We were the first generation to have two cars and a snowmobile and a boat.
Color television.
Color televisions in every room.
Right.
In the bathroom.
Yeah.
You know, we were the first generation to have three bathrooms in our house instead of one. We were the first generation to have second homes proliferate around the country, to travel all over.
Huge saving accounts.
Yeah. We lived the life of Riley, and we weren't, unfortunately, trying to pass it on to the next generation. In fact, we were the first generation that asked our children to undertake debt so they could go to college.
Let's go to Lynn from Oconomowoc. Good morning to you, Lynn. Thank you very much for the call. You say what?
Thank you for taking my call, Earl. I just wanted to mention going into the military. Last year, I was at my family's 98th family reunion in Franklin, Illinois, which is pretty much in the middle of nowhere, southwest of Springfield, Illinois. And I was sitting next to a young man, and he was talking about graduating from high school this year. And I said, oh, have you picked out a college yet? And he said, I mean, going into the Marines. And I looked at his mother with wide eyes, and she kind of just shook her head. This kid was adamant about going into the Marines. On the other hand, I talked to my grandson, who's growing up in Oconomowoc, and he was 16 at the time, and I asked him, we talk about the military and the war and different topics. And he said, Grandma, I don't want to die on a battlefield in the Ukraine. And so very divergent growing up possibly in a rural area versus growing up in a more suburban area.
You know, Sandy, I think she's kind of put her finger on it, right?
Well, the American military has become a place that's the profile of those who enter it voluntarily frequently involves a lower income level. So it's young people in pursuit of income experiences. It's actually whiter than America is in terms of the profile. So, you know, the problem, I think, with our military is that when we had a draft, the military reflected our country. Now that we have a volunteer military, it doesn't. It reflects the people who are essentially interested in going to the military for their own reasons. And when we had a draft, and I think the reason we got rid of the draft after Vietnam is that those in power realized that having a draft and having everyone, young person in the country, subject to potentially going in the military was putting the military into a bright spotlight and putting our foreign relations into a bright spotlight with the young generation that it was uncomfortable having. You know, Vietnam was something that was basically the conflict was put into contest as a policy by a young generation. It was the young people of America that prompted America to rethink Vietnam.
You know, Sandy, she, again, clearly wanted to draw a distinction between rural people going into the military and suburban people going into the military.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on that?
Well, we got to, that's the red-blue thing, maybe. I mean, you know, we've got the rural experience is materially different than the urban experience. Probably always has been, but politically and particularly the conservatives today have grabbed a hold of the flag and patriotism. And I do think that if someone grows up in a conservative household in today's world, that part of the litmus of that household is to be extremely patriotic. And for a young person to demonstrate patriotism, I suppose volunteering for the military is a primary way.
You know, and I just, as a person who has steered young urban children who did not know what they wanted to do into the military, I've done that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, kids who did not know where they wanted to go, what they wanted to do, to graduate and know they're not going to college and take a job that's going to lead them to a dead-end job.
Well, you know,
not a good thing. So I would steer these young guys and young ladies into the military to find themselves, to be able to travel, to be able to do. You know, Sandy, if people, even today I would do that. Well, right?
Yeah, but one of the problems with the military is that its business, unfortunately, you know, when it's called upon to do what it does, is war. And happily for those in the military, only about 1 in 8 in the military actually see conflict, and so they're spared the problems of being a combatant. But just like football has kind of found out that its dirty little secret is potentially CTE and head injuries,
right,
and they're frantically trying to figure out how to deal with that. I think the dirty little secret of the military is, you know, what they used to call combat fatigue, or you know, it's PTSD. It's the rehab that every combatant needs to go through to recover from combat. And unfortunately, I think an awful lot of young people have seen now their older siblings or people down the block or their parents who are involved in that rehab process from being a combatant. And it's an extremely, you know, it's fraught with risk. Some people never recover, but the recovery process is painful.
So, Sandy, I want to switch gears. Electric vehicles. Now, Ford has the F-150 electric truck. It's got, I think the Mustang is now electric.
Yeah, they have a Mustang.
Ford, on the other hand,
mm-hmm,
has not done that.
Oh, yeah, no, that is Ford. Mustang.
Oh, yeah, I mean the Lincoln.
Yeah.
Which is the other arm.
Yeah, the arm of Ford Lincoln, yeah.
They have chosen not to do electric.
Uh-huh.
So you haven't done the electric thing yet. And yet, is it safe to say, Sandy, that they're going to be able to force enough people in enough time?
Well, I don't think they're going to have to force people. I to be honest with you, I'm eager to do electric. It's just that I don't have the charger.
Oh, right.
In my garage, I sort of, the infrastructure is a little bit daunting, but I've ridden in and driven electric vehicles.
It's got the same power?
Oh, more. It's an exceedingly exciting experience. The power curve on an electric motor is unbelievable, and it's like sitting in a rocket ship. It keeps going faster and faster instead of reaching a power peak and then dropping off. And I think electric vehicles are simply not in common supply now because the production isn't yet up. The cost of them is somewhat higher than a combustion engine car. And people are just, you know, you're sort of daunted by the fact of stepping out of gasoline into electric, by the question of charging, frequency of charging, et cetera. But I can assure you that the driving experience is something that people will want to step into. And they're already, Porsche has the Taycan, you know, the fastest car in their stable is an electric car.
So Sandy, you right away brought up something that I hadn't even thought about. The cost with putting your own electric charging unit on your own property. That has to be cost prohibitive.
No, it's not cost prohibitive. It's probably under $1,000, but you need an electrician to come. He's got to put in a 440 circuit for you or a 220.
So for $1,000, you can get that done?
I think so. I think that the manufacturers are trying to make their charging package affordable. They don't want that to be the thing that keeps people from doing this. But, you know, and then you just have to have cars of a sufficient range. You know, when I keep reading articles about them and saying, well, 200 miles, let's see. That's a little tight. I go to Chicago, come back on a cold day.
I can't maybe
do that, you know. So, I think the sweet spot is got to be more than 300 miles for people to be comfortable. That's a tank of gas. So, what do I think about electric vehicles? I think that they are the future. And that the people are going to want them, but they aren't going to be forced to buy them.
So Calvin, why don't you look up what percentage of Americans have electric vehicles? Sandy, what would you say it is? 3?
Less.
Oh, it's even less than 3%.
I think so. I don't know. It's probably 2.5. You know, it's growing rapidly. The percentage of new cars that are electric that are sold is going up every year. And I don't know what – I think the real question is, what is the percentage of new cars that are sold in America? What percentage of those are electric?
Listen, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. Yeah, we want to look at those numbers because it does say a lot. We'll be right back. Sandy's. Us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. Oh, it's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. So Calvin, what are some of the numbers on these electric vehicles, man?
Yeah, so it looks like they're trending up. It's hard to – it looks like they make up about 25% of new car sales. I can buy having trouble finding about like what the percentage of registrations.
Well, Sandy found.
Yeah, I found something that suggested that of the 250 million vehicles in the United States in 2020, that 1% of those were electric, and that in the year prior to that, or in that year, 10% of the new cars sold were electric. But the trend, you're right, the trend is going up rapidly with respect to the percent of new cars sold that are electric. On the horizon, you can see that the manufacturers are shifting quickly in the direction of manufacturing more versions of electric vehicles.
Let's go to Ken from Sturgeon Bay. Good morning, Ken. You say what, sir? Thank you for the call.
Good morning, gentlemen. Yeah, just a little information on the electric at-home chargers. You would have to have 200 amps stalled in, ideally. With 100-amp service running 60-amp breaker, you couldn't use your stove and charge electric vehicle at the same time. In order to get 200-amp service, the average household is $6,000 to $8,000 because that has to be taken off the pole and run into the ground, upgraded cable service charge. And only about 55 to 60% of households in America have 200-amp service.
But the 200-amp service is going to newer households, isn't it? The new homes that are being built?
Yes,
are,
it is.
Yeah,
well,
so.
No, it's been out for some time already, but... Yeah. All your houses that are older than 30, 40 years old, that's all 100-amp service. You could charge it, but you wouldn't be able to use anything else in your household. And your electric bill, on the other hand, it would be like leaving your oven on for 10 to 12 hours to charge your car.
Well, my understanding is that the people who are buying these must be people who don't face that kind of cost to increase the basic electric service in their homes, and that the homes that already have the 200-amp service – the conversion that they need to make to create the outlets in their garage is not prohibitively expensive.
So Sandy, based on what you have talked about, the percentage of Americans who live paycheck to paycheck clearly are not going to be able to.
No, I mean, the problem is that the cost of the automobile, currently the electric automobile, that includes a battery. The battery is the most expensive element in the car. And some Chinese manufacturers are coming up with ways to provide that when you buy the car, you don't buy the battery, you essentially lease the battery. There is a tendency, some of the manufacturers are looking at replaceable batteries, so that instead of going having to pull off the road and plug in for a half an hour, you pull off the road in a battery shop and it takes 5 minutes to replace your battery, and you're off and running again with a new battery because you've leased it, and someone else owns the battery, and you're simply paying for it like you would gasoline. I think in the long run, that's going to be the future of this. And you should understand that the cost of an automobile that doesn't include a battery that is driven by electric motors is probably cheaper than a combustion engine. Electric motors are far cheaper to manufacture than combustion engines.
Calvin, you had something you want to add?
Yeah, I just did a little Googling of what Ken just said because it didn't sound right to me. And I'm not an electrician by any means, but this article says all electric vehicles come compatible with 110-volt home connector kit, meaning you don't have to do any upgrading to your electric services to plug your car in at home. And then you can get a level 2 240-volt upgrade kit, but you can buy them at Amazon, Home Depot, or Lowe's for $500 to $700. So this barrier to entry, I don't think is what Ken is trying to make it out to be.
You know, I don't know. Sandy, you thought that was a bit...
Well, I'm not an electrician, and right. Ken might be. And amperage service to a house could well matter. And I know that old houses have had different electric service that needs to be re-upped. I just put in a backup power generator in my house and dealt with some of those issues, but it didn't cost anything like that.
Ken is gone. But Sandy, so so this is, I was thinking this was imminent, that electric vehicles, you know, I mean, when you drive around, don't see many of them on the road.
I think it is imminent, though. Everyone I talk to when they buy a combustion engine car now will say, I think this might be the last combustion engine car I'll buy. So, you know, I think this is another one of those futures that bodes, has an interesting aspects to it, probably doesn't bode well for the people who work in assembly plants and assemble combustion engines.
So Sandy, the other part of it is the segment of the population who can buy a new car every couple of years is a lot smaller than the segment of the population that can. And so the people who will be buying the electric cars are the people who are buying new cars every couple of years.
Absolutely. And we've just said, you know, the stock of existing vehicles is 250 million. It'll take 15 years to work that pig through the snake in terms of selling used cars that continue to be combustion-based. So, you know, and I think hybrid cars will continue to play a significant role. Hybrid cars sort of solve the range problem.
So it is, Sandy, to me, it's an interesting conversation because now I see it through a different vision. I'm really thinking that this is something that's going to be coming in the next few years, but you just stated, you know, gradually we're going to see it. We're not going to see, you know, combustible engines just disappear.
No, they won't. No, like you said, pointed out, used cars will continue to rule the marketplace in terms of the people. Most people buy used cars, not new cars. So,
right.
You know, feeding the electric cars, if they're currently going in at 20% or 25% of the new cars being sold, which I think is a forecast, not a historical number, that number would have to get up to 100%, and you'd still take a while to work that existing stock.
So do you think it's any different in foreign countries than it is here? You think they're more in Europe?
Well, I know that Norway, and I don't know whether they had a program, but when I was in Norway 3 years ago, a significant percentage of new cars being sold in Norway were electric, and I think it continues to be the country in which the highest percentage of new cars sold are electric.
All right, we got to go. Thank you, everybody, who made the show go. Thank you, Kelvin, as always. We'll be back. Been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. See you later.
My heart cries out for your touch, but you're not there, and the lonely cry fades in the air.
Love is here.